Thank you, Andy, and apologies to Mike Chauff and Andy. And I had my own travel mishaps last year and missed this symposium, so
I'm. Can you
use the microphone? Sure. Yeah. Thanks. I'm actually glad to have been invited back after skipping out last year. I'll see if I can do it as well as Preston. Okay. So the next two talks, I guess, will be about a taxonomically minor sect of the Hymenoptera, but an important species ecologically, of course, and economically, the honeybee. I'm going to talk a bit about, more generally, with some genetics issues with honeybees, but also about the genome project that is actually ongoing with honeybees, and then go to another biological phenomenon, or a sociological phenomenon, by which colonies are suffering greatly from honeybees of late. For genetics, and especially in this, the context of this talk will be more genetics of honeybees in relation to things that attack them. There's a diversity of targets and things that are targeting honeybees, from two mite species that are prevalent in the Western or European honeybee, to viruses, bacteria, fungi, microsporidia, really a whole range of parasites and pathogens for these insects, and a well-studied one because of, again, mostly the economic importance of bees. I'll talk briefly about a bacterium that's important for honeybee health in the negative way. It's a gram-positive bacterium that causes the disease American foul brood. And we've been interested in the sort of individual responses of bees that ingest spores of this bacterium, and especially whether they mount an immune response that helps slow the growth of the bacterium and possibly lets them molt and eventually escape the disease. So the questions that we've been looking at are whether tolerance of larvae or resistance varies across genotypes and across colonies, and if this is due to what's a conventional immune response, or if it's something mechanical. And this project was partly in the field with some field colonies, enough to so that we could validate that some bees were resistant to this bacterium, but largely in incubators. And these are honeybee larvae, which is a nice trick of honeybees that you can actually raise them in captivity, even more so than the white box captivity they're doomed to. And we bring the larvae into the lab and actually inoculate them with this bacterium to see how they fare. The experiment that I'll describe briefly here, it was carried out by Laura Decanini, who worked with me, and what she was, the interest was treating honeybees essentially as a domestic animal and trying to find traits within them that helped resist this disease. So it was sort of a conventional mating scheme. I don't have to tell this crowd that they're haplodiploid, so we could take advantage of that to some extent, and of the fact, the tool of artificial insemination. So we were able to set up some fairly efficient screens for genetic variability and heritability, true narrow sense heritability for this trait, by bringing in drones, crossing drones into a common female background. And the results of this were, we were able to show that this is a trait that's both highly variable in domestic populations of honeybees across different lines, and one that could be pushed potentially by a breeding scheme. And that was suggestive that the immune response generally was important. Of course, most of the variance we saw was not explained by the genes that we looked at, and so this is something that I've been deeply interested in with genomics, is how we can actually go back and now look at other traits, maybe more physiological traits rather than the conventional immune response, that play into this and help them resist this and other diseases. And this project was carried out for all the entomological reasons that we were passionate about and agricultural reasons, but also because honeybees have come across as helping with medical models, models for learning and behavior, certainly, and disease resistance and pathologies, also communication. They're, as Christina will show in beautiful details, bees are social organisms like us, and they've been excellent models for chemical communication especially. And that driving force, the sort of relevance to human health, is really what pushed this particular insect project going. And the actual mechanics of it were carried out at a human genome sequencing center. So this is in Houston, Texas. And a group of folks who have sequenced a good chunk of the human genome and also work on organisms of direct importance to human health, but lately, in the past decade, have been devoting their talents to comparative studies of different organisms that might help understand human health issues. And honeybee was the first sort of agriculturally important insect chosen in that realm. And this project was carried out over the course of about 4 years in the end, and they did the bulk of the sequencing, and then the actual project pulling together the biological insights was dispersed across a number of members of the bee community, entomologists, folks who weren't necessarily trained, as and including myself, not trained in bioinformatics in this, but we were able to partition out the parts of the genome that particularly interested us, so related to behavior, to disease, and actually work up vignettes or research projects out of each part of the genome. I put up these stats. These are the sort of nuts and bolts stats of the genome project at the time it was published, in part because they're incredibly modest. And if you were to take another hymenopteran or another insect generally and mount a genome project right now, you could achieve the pink line on the top, which is the sort of the fold coverage of the genome that's been sequenced. That's about maybe a $70,000 project now. So this is something that could be done on a standard research grant at a single institution at this point, given new sequencing technologies. And so it's fairly wide open for, and hopefully will be exploited by lots of insects. And these are resources for honeybee. There are similar resources now for insects in the four major holometabola orders and the aphid and others coming online for hemipterans and the body louse. So there are resources for gathering up sequences, maybe more importantly, some resources with annotations or insights into what these genes all mean for different traits. And this is an evolving database. Chris Elzik, who's here, is leading that and posting that information freely as it comes in. So there's a great wealth of data that can actually help lots of biological questions for these organisms. I'll talk just briefly about the fraction that interested me both on this most on this project, which is how honeybees resist disease. We went from having six total immune-related genes in the honeybee to the, I think, a representative set of the full system, four different pathways that are involved in immunity. And that was, it literally saved years and years of work for these questions. This is one such pathway, the Toll pathway. The red gene targets or genes on there are ones that seem responsive to actual diseases that we've challenged them with. One interesting trait of bees that came from this initial survey is that they really didn't have a robust or a diversified, I guess, immune system. They had members of each of these pathways. The pathways themselves seemed functional, but there was no redundancy in many cases. And with that, what we believe that means is they're less able they have a less broad response to potential pathogens. And this could be because those pathogens are restricted, the ones that have actually cracked the nut of exploiting bees are restricted, or we think it might have something to do with the fact that honeybees have another layer of protection. They have a group that shows hygienic behavior and protects maybe the more vulnerable life stages like the larvae. The larvae themselves are partitioned in sterile cups. We've been able to, many people have been able to take the information now and actually use it towards applied goals to understand bee disease, and the most, or maybe the higher profile such goal has been to try to understand a rather mysterious phenomenon where honeybees, which are generally at peril from parasites and pathogens and pesticides and all sorts of causes, started to die at a much higher rate, in the U.S. at least, over the winter of 2006 to 2007. And it was mysterious both in the sort of suddenness of these declines when they occurred and also in the lack of any obvious pathologies. So we're used to seeing larval disease pathologies and others. Those simply weren't evident from this syndrome. And there were three broad classes of hypotheses that were raised and I think are still surviving, along with dozens more that have come up and maybe been dismissed or at least haven't yet found their niche in terms of support. The three classes that I think are most promising are either there's something to do with nutrition, that the bees suffering this phenomenon at the colony level were simply fed poorly as larvae, and they came out as less had shorter longevities over the winter or and other times. The other sort of external threats are chemicals from the environment, which could be pesticides or chemicals used in the nest, and of course parasites and pathogens. And what we're able to do, and once this phenomenon started, is get out in the field and actually collect bees that were directly showing signs of this syndrome. So bringing out buckets of dry ice and bringing back bees. And I'll talk very quickly about three different routes that have been used to start to try to understand maybe what's going on with these bees and give insights into this mystery. The first is a project that's being carried out by Reed Johnson and colleagues May Barenbaum and Gene Robinson at the University of Illinois. And it's to simply open the search up to every annotated gene from the genome. So we have a gene set of about 11,000 genes and then some candidates that are partial gene models. These were all put onto a microarray, a slide for screening gene activities. And the idea was to see if the sickened bees or the bees that were collapsing showed a different signal in terms of the expression or activities of those genes. And indeed, there were some that popped out that way. This is ongoing. Reed is still working on this. But there were genes that came out as being differently regulated or having different titers, at least, in these sickened or collapsing colonies. And within those, some that were perhaps plausible biological being involved in different threats to the bees, and a bunch of others that we simply don't know why, either their function at all or why they might change with this syndrome. We also did a more targeted search, and this again was with folks at the University of Illinois, Gene Robinson and May Barenbaum, trying to address those three hypotheses more or less, trying to look for genes whose activity might play into whether this was caused by an environmental insult like a chemical or a pathogen threat. And these are the classes. There are genes that are responsive to different classes of pesticides, insecticides, a set of genes from the genome annotation that we believe are responsive to different classes of pathogens. And then in red, on the red column is a bunch of pathogens themselves. And this is an attempt to simply see what the bees are carrying throughout the syndrome. And this is the trend from that. These are quantitative PCR estimates of those different gene products. And honestly, there wasn't a lot striking right off the bat from that, and this is a smaller sample size that's been grown a bit, but there weren't, for example, detoxification enzymes that were obviously different in the collapsing bees, and even in the immune responses. And many of us had proposed and believed that there was perhaps something going on with the immune systems of these bees. We're not seeing an across-the-board difference in transcript levels for at least what we have now as candidate immune genes. The pathogens have been actually much more interesting on the whole. There's been a number of viruses that have come out at higher titers in samples collected in collapsing areas, in colonies that have collapsed. And of course, the question that many people are working on now is whether that's causal or whether it's the bees have had a primary insult of some sort and the viruses and bacteria are reflecting that, they're the loads. But if you look across collapsing bees, and these three columns repeated across there on the left are historical bees, which are actually back to 2002, strong bees collected in the time of colony collapse and then in actively collapsing colonies. we see four viruses that are actually increased in titer. We also see one of the two Nosema species, one of these Microsporidia that has a higher load, and a trypanosome parasite. So it looks like, in a sense, a number of pathogens are actually higher in these sickened or collapsing bees. And this is a sort of one way to visualize this, which is to look both at the loads of those pathogens in the circles there for various viruses and Microsporidia represent their actual loads. And then the dark bars are actually covariances. So if you look at the strong colonies, and these are strong colonies collected in the time of colony collapse, there seems to be a sort of positive covariation with two of the viruses, Kashmir bee virus and IAPV, Israeli acute paralysis virus, both of which are involved with disease. But if you look at the weakened colonies, they have this mass of interactions basically a sign that bees that have one virus or pathogen tend to have a number of them. I'll briefly say there's a geographic pattern to this too, where if we sample in the west, we get a slightly different view from bees collected in the east. And again, that might suggest, or it suggests to me that there's the pathogens that are exploiting some other condition within the bees. So to summarize that, the loads of pathogens are up in these collapsing bees. They come in threes, or there's groups. So bees that have one virus will tend to have maybe several, and we still don't quite understand that. Since this is a genomics talk, and since I think Christina's talk will be really what's going on in the future of genomics, I'm going to briefly give one last slide on where the honeybee has come in a very short time, and also again say that this is true for virtually any insect within the diverse orders of insects right now, that we can generate sequence data and assemble and make sense of it at an incredibly fast rate now. For honeybees, of course, it took 4 years for the genome. In that same time frame, though, we got genome sequences for 8 different virus species, these RNA viruses, and also for the fungal pathogen, key pathogen of honeybees, and a bacterial pathogen. And those are the pathogens, in a sense, are relatively easy genomes to capture, and they can now be used for disease. Also ongoing are projects to sequence those two Microsporidian species in the genus Nosema that are important. Actually, Microsporidia are important across insects and higher eukaryotes as parasites, and Varroa mites. And the Varroa mite case is interesting in that for the honeybee, we budgeted, or there's a budget of about $8 million for that genome project to get the same level of coverage that I showed for the honeybee in Varroa mites, which have a slightly larger genome. It's going to be about $70,000. So we have a hundredfold reduction, in a sense, of the cost for generating these sorts of reagents to study. And briefly, just acknowledge colleagues at the USDA and the Genome Consortium and great colleagues at Penn State, Columbia, Arizona, and Illinois. It's funding. But yeah, Christina.
So, from what you're standpoint,
of CCD, did you try, like, to look at that in order? Okay, that's a good. So the question is the sampling for CCD, these are social organisms, and did we sample consistently one or the other type? It's very hard with the collapsed colonies because there's just a little bundle of bees, and that's a worry about the age structure of that group. The older foragers, yeah. So we didn't see any I shouldn't say that. There's vitellogenin, which is an age transformative trait, was lower in the collapsed bee colonies. That could reflect older bees, I guess. And the others were sampled within the nest for the healthy colonies. Reed has done some work, I think, with older foragers, and they're not, for the sorts of patterns and genes that we've seen, they're not strikingly different. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a particular time of year that colony collapse disorder occurred
more? Okay. Yeah, I think it was sort of definitive for when bees came out of a quiet time, in a sense, in the spring. The first cases were when they arrived in Florida, ironically in late fall, but they came out of a from Pennsylvania when they had cooled down and kind of gone into their winter state. So it seems like it's most prevalent as bees start up brood rearing again after a pause. So early spring usually.